Is he still? Is he still increasing?
Yeah, everybody. Seems like him real well.
Go right ahead. Oh, excuse me. I'll just, are we broadcasting this meeting? Okay, that's great. We put these out over the internet. People have the schedule. If they're interested, they can tune in at this time. It's approximately 11 o'clock. We're in the commission hearing room. We have folks with us today from the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership, and they're from EERC up at the University of North Dakota, and they've been working on this for several years. And just to give you an idea of who's with us in the room today, we have a number of people from our reclamation staff who are here. We have Tom Rafferty, who works with us on consumer affairs and public outreach. And we also have, I think what we'll do is just have people go around and introduce themselves and tell where you're from. Okay, that will help the speakers. Go ahead. Starting, I'm Commissioner Susan Wiefald.
I'm Kevin
Kramer.
And I'm Tony Clark. I'm mm-hmm. the commission as well. Welcome.
Jim Deitch with Reclamation, AML Divisions.
Kim Christensen with the Department of Commerce State Energy Office.
Jerry Lynn with PSC staff.
Dean Moses of the Reclamation Division.
Tom Rafferty, PSC staff.
Phil Bennett, PSC.
Bruce Beachy with the Reclamation Division.
Bill Dodd, Abandoned Mine Lands Division.
Bruce Johnson, Reclamation Division.
Guy Welch, PSC.
Steve Gall, PSC.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, PSC.
Go ahead.
Mike Diller, staff, PSC.
Jack Green, I live
in Bismarck. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you'll introduce yourself and go right into your program.
I'm John Haru with the EERC.
And I'm Ed Stedman with the EERC. Now, what I did today was I just put together a bit of background on the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership. I'm going to go over that very quickly, and then we can get right into questions you may have about what we're doing now and what our planned activities are going to be. And I think hopefully this will provide you some pretty good background of that. Of course, everybody hears about, we've been hearing a lot about global warming, and there's a CO2 cycle on the Earth, and the anthropogenic or man-induced activities, specifically in large part the emissions from fossil fuel-fired systems are seemingly upsetting that balance of the CO2 in the atmosphere, and atmospheric CO2 is at a very high point with respect to the past 5 million years or so in the Earth. And pre-industrialized, it was 250 parts per million, and we're up to 380 parts per million. And, of course, the concern is, because it is a greenhouse gas and it is building up in the atmosphere, that we have to curb those emissions at some point, or else it's just going to continue to rise because it has a very long half-life in the atmosphere. And, of course, human population is increasing at a very rapid rate, and the rate of energy consumption is increasing at an even more rapid rate. And the dominant energy source in the world is fossil fuels. It's 85%. And even with the most optimistic views of what can happen with renewable energy and alternate energy sources, fossil fuels are going to be an important part of our energy mix for many decades to come. In response to this, the world developed the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and it calls for a 7% reduction in carbon emission from 1990 levels. The United States did not ratify the Kyoto Protocol, and President Bush established a Global Climate Change Initiative, which calls for an 18% intensity reduction in CO2 by 2012. The Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership is part of that Global Climate Change Initiative that the President has put in place, and this is administered through the Department of Energy, and I won't get into the details of all these different aspects of it, but it has an international component. It's integrated through a FutureGen program, and the regional partnerships are the infrastructure that supports these activities. There are 7 regional partnerships across the United States. The Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership, or the P-Corps Partnership, you hear me refer to, is located at the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota. We were successful in a competitive solicitation with DOE to become one of the regional partnerships, And you can see in green there on the PowerPoint slide, we have an area across the central interior of North America, which is over 1.4 million square miles. It goes all the way from Missouri on up through the four Canadian provinces, a portion of British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba.
Why does ours have two stars, Big Sky and Plains?
Big Sky is another partnership which is managed out of the out of Montana, and portions of their territory overlap the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership. So that's why you get some of the shading of green and things. The Big Sky Partnership is the darker green, and the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership is the lighter green area. We only cover eastern Montana, for instance, and a portion of British Columbia. Big Sky covers Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and South Dakota. So there's some overlap among our partnerships. And you see a little bit of that in the Southwest Partnership and Southeast, too, as well.
The way that the original solicitation was released by the Department of Energy, they encouraged regional partnerships. They did not specify a series of regions and then have competitions from within those regions. What they asked for was people to bring forward partnerships, and we did so.
And there's no sequestration opportunities up in the Northeast?
Well, there actually are. Particularly upstate New York has some fairly significant sequestration opportunities. I don't know how viable they are from a socioeconomic perspective, but geologically, scientifically, they're good opportunities in that part of the nation.
But presently, that portion isn't covered, although I've heard that New York State is joining the Northeastern Partnership there eventually. Soon.
Or the Midwest, or is there a different?
Right, Midwest, I should say, yes.
Yeah, there's actually two Midwest partnerships, oddly enough. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're concerned about anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, what can you do? Renewable energy technologies, advanced high-efficiency energy systems. You can improve the efficiency in existing systems. You can simply reduce the consumption of energy. The only other thing left is sequester greenhouse gas emissions, and that's what the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership is about. If you do all these, you have to do all these things if you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from fossil energy. But the first four on the list aren't enough. So it ends up that if you're really serious about reducing these over the next coming decades, where we're still very much reliant on fossil fuels, we also have to look into the sequestration or long-term storage of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's what the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership is all about.
If you could go back to that slide.
Yes.
Because I think that's an important one. Could you go over with us the top picture there and the bottom diagrams?
Okay. The top picture is in more detail, shown in more detail in the next slide. So I can do that then. In the bottom, it's just meant to depict renewable energy like wind power, very important. Advanced, the middle one is to show advanced combustion and gasification systems, which is a very important part of getting more energy and more environmentally sustainable energy out of these fossil systems. And the thermometer is just meant to say, hey, if we're turning down the thermostats, just conserving energy, even on an individual basis, is a very important part of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But using the information provided by DOE and others, if you do all those things as much as you can, the most optimistic view of doing all those things, it still will result in increased greenhouse gas emissions in years to come. And so we have to look at another technology, and that technology is sequestration. And then the next slide is where I'm going to talk about what sequestration really is. There are fundamentally two types of sequestration. Terrestrial sequestration, and that's where you adopt land management practices that enhance the natural uptake of CO2 from the atmosphere by plants and ultimately their incorporation into soils and sediments. So things like planting forests, managing wetlands in an alternate way, no-till or reduced-till farming are all ways that we can manage the landscape in a way that increases the amount of carbon dioxide, which is naturally pulled from the atmosphere by plants, in the photosynthetic process and storing that CO2, storing that carbon ultimately into soils and sediments. This is a natural process, but since industrial times, industrialization, we have depleted, in many cases, the carbon in the soils and elsewhere, so we have a stock of carbon that can be restored into those soils. It's very good environmentally. It's good for the soils. Enhanced carbon in the soils is good. And terrestrial sequestration is a very viable and important part of carbon management, we think, in the future. The trouble with terrestrial sequestration is it's limited because once you've restored those soils or restored the forest or restored the wetlands to a certain point, to the point where it's back in equilibrium with nature, you can't store any more carbon in there. It'll just go back into that carbon cycle and be cycled back and forth in the atmosphere. And so there's a limit to the amount of time and the amount of carbon that can be stored in that manner.
Just a quick aside. When we showed the increase in atmospheric CO2 from pre-industrialized days to today, about half of that CO2 in the atmosphere, half of the increase, is actually due to tilling of the landscape. So releasing that carbon that was in those natural stores in the soils, that tilling actually is in and of itself is responsible for about half of the increase seen in the industrialized age.
Excellent point. So by managing the landscape in a little different manner, again, we'll use the reduced till concept, you pull that carbon back into the soils, and it's good for the soils and good for the atmosphere. The other type of sequestration is geologic sequestration. And that's where you actually go to the sources of the CO2, for instance, a power plant or some other industrial source that is burning fossil fuels. Anytime you burn a fossil fuel, CO2 is released. And the geologic sequestration uses technology to collect that CO2. Rather than releasing it into the atmosphere, as it is typically done today, you collect that CO2 and then pump it deep underground into appropriate storage reservoirs. And ultimately, this is where it came from in the first place. These fossil fuels, from the oil and coal and so forth, the CO2 is burned, and we're taking it, compressing it, and pumping it back underground into areas that have the geologic conditions where this CO2, this would stay down there for the foreseeable future, for in geologic time.
As I understand it, there are specific geologic formations that allow it, and some that just don't.
That's absolutely correct.
Does North Dakota tend to be in a favorable geologic position?
Very much so.
Okay.
One thing to think about, in all of the earliest literature on sequestration, the Williston Basin is typically held up as, you know, the most favorable place on Earth to do this. What you look for are conditions just like those that we have here. When you think about, you know, if the U.S. moves down a carbon-managed policy framework, which it appears it will, you can really think of this regionally as a strategic advantage because we do have more favorable geology than does much of the country.
Yeah, there's a lot of sections of the country, particularly, and many of them more populated, so that produce a lot of CO2 that just don't have the proper geology. So this isn't an option open to them. And ultimately, if we go to the carbon-constrained world, they may have to purchase carbon credits from us out here in the Williston Basin and other appropriate areas that have that opportunity.
So is it really that any area in our country that produces oil or gas in the past would have those reservoirs? So, for example, the state of Ohio could have a lot because they've had a lot of oil and gas in their state.
That's a reasonable and good rule of thumb, yes. But in the absolute sense, you still have additional constraints on this. And the older those producing regions, the less integrity some of those reservoirs may have.
So how about Texas?
Texas, in particular, has some absolutely fantastic places to geologically store CO2. Mm-hmm. When you get into the older, more mature portions of the country, much of the hydrocarbon resource base was exploited in a much less modern way than it's been done in North Dakota. With the first discovery well in the 1950s here, there's an extremely good knowledge base with respect to where boreholes have been, where boreholes have penetrated hydrocarbon formations. And in other parts of the country, there is less, there's information is of lesser quality when it comes to precisely where might those boreholes have been entered into. And realistically, on the best, some of the best sinks, old boreholes are things that are probably not conducive to maintaining integrity of those sinks.
And Ohio would be
stability important too. I mean, you
geologic
stability is tectonic area. Or
absolutely,
exactly, and that's another thing that we have in spades, particularly in the Williston Basin. It's very tectonically stable, very deep. It's layer cake type geology that has seals, multiple seals. And so it's just an ideal place.
CO2 actually can act as a lubricant in the, I mean, I don't know if that's the right word, but it, and is that one of the reasons for the geologic stability that can actually, in a in an unstable area, can make it more likely, especially if you're pressurizing with this particular substance, it it makes it more likely that it'll break apart.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And injection, per se, has typically been something that's a concern in terms of seismicity.
Right.
And there's good record in those areas that are not as tectonically stable where injection has actually induced seismicity, particularly Colorado is a good...
That's the example I had heard.
Yeah. Colorado is... That's really the known place where these data have been.
Now, what this doesn't show on this chart is it shows coal bed methane formations, but it doesn't show lignite formations. And I've been, from what I understand, you're exploring putting the CO2 into unusable lignite formations in North Dakota. One thing that I'm wondering about is how do you ensure the integrity of those? It's one thing to have a geologic formation where you have the gas and oil reservoirs, which are several thousand feet down into the ground. But as it shows, even on your coal bed methane formations, they're much closer to the surface. So how does that work?
Or can be.
Or can be, right. So that's not to scale. It's just a kind of a cartoon. You know, typically we wouldn't consider anything certainly above 500 feet. And also you wouldn't consider any place where there would be any potable water or any chance with interaction with potable water. So you're going to have to be deep enough to get below any potable water sources.
The coal seam sequestration that we are currently working towards implementation on, the depth of that seam is actually about 1,600 feet.
Mm-hmm. And I actually have some more information on that coming up.
That'd probably be unmineable.
Oh, it's unmineable. Economically.
Economically.
What's the concern about water? Is it? When I think about POP, that's just...
Well, I mean, actually, if you look at the pH of a can of Coca-Cola,
right.
It's very acidic.
Yeah. And it's related to the CO2?
It's related to the CO2.
Yeah,
it's CO2 in water dissociates to what's called carbonic acid.
Yeah, so.
And that's what's actually, I've heard it as being used for enhancing wetlands. How does it do that?
Well, this is one of these terrestrial actions. So we're not physically pumping CO2 into the wetland, but actually... What you're looking at is altering the management of the landscape in the vicinity of the wetlands. If you farm immediately to the edge of the wetland, effectively what you have are additional inputs of fertilizers that you might not otherwise have if you had a bit of a buffer zone around the wetland. And what happens when fertilizer enters a wetland environment? Ultimately, you end up with boosts in the microbial community where they would produce two things typically that are of primary concern. One is methane, which is actually a much more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2. And the other is nitrous oxide from the degradation of fertilizer as well, that is also a much more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2. So by simply minimizing inputs of those types of materials, what you're doing is offsetting those emissions. And the other thing that happens is wetlands do, through the vegetation on their periphery as well as under the surface of the water, incorporate a significant amount of CO2 from the atmosphere directly. And when you see these mucks, you know, kind of on the bottom of a wetland, it's very, very rich in carbon. So in any event, wetlands are a good place to, you know, scour CO2 from the atmosphere. But if you could also mitigate the emission of these other compounds, on a per-acre basis, it's more than 10 times as effective as various other terrestrial activities. So very significant sequestration. Now, of course, you don't have the same amount of landscape that you would be able to turn into that sort of a activity. So
the primary target, you know, you want to make sure that what you're putting this into is somewhere it's going to stay over thousands and even millions of years. Primary target would be oil and gas reservoirs, in part because they've already proven their ability to trap and store liquids over millions of years. That's why there are oil and gas deposits there. And plus, there's an potential economic recovery there, which we'll get into in a little bit. Unminable coal seams have a capacity to store CO2 as well, and it's physically adsorbed, so you don't have concerns over leakage that you might have in some other types of strata. And then deep saline formations have no economic value. They're deep. They're too saline for any kind of beneficial use, and they also have a significant capacity to hold CO2 over a very long period of time. So those are your primary targets for sequestration. And again, we've got all those opportunities in the Williston Basin. Talking a little bit about recovery and capture. Capture is kind of depending on the type of fuel utilization system you have, capture can be one of the more problematic or one of the areas that needs more research to bring the prices down. We can capture the CO2 today, but in many cases it's quite expensive and, of course, would add significantly to the cost of the energy being produced. One of the ways we can offset that is through enhanced resource recovery projects, such as enhanced oil recovery. When an oil field is developed, typically you've got the primary production that happens, and then you've got secondary production. The secondary production is typically a water flood type thing where you sweep the oil with water. And then we have tertiary recovery. Which is typically often CO2 is used for tertiary recovery. That's because CO2 mixes with it's what's called a miscible flood because it mixes with the oil, and so you're not only sweeping it, you're reducing the viscosity of that oil, allowing more oil to be recovered. And actually, we've done an assessment of the opportunities in the Williston Basin, and they're tremendous. And this is because the timing, often many of these fields have undergone secondary recovery for a number of years, and the best indication of the potential of the tertiary recovery using the CO2 is the efficiency and success of your secondary recovery using a water flood technique. And so there's a tremendous amount of capacity out there for storing CO2 underground, but there's also tremendous opportunity to extend the life of the oil fields that are out there in the Williston Basin by as much as 30 years.
If the concern is carbon, is it a one-for-one, though? I mean, do you know what I mean? Well, if you're just using carbon to pump out other carbon,
our best analysis of this, and because there are not mature projects to date in the Williston Basin, The first commercial scale project that has been undertaken, as you're well aware, is in Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually looking at about half the depth of that which we're going to be encountering on you know, our portion of the basin. Mm-hmm. So the lack of maturity and the lack of similar depth don't really allow us as great a ability to extrapolate exactly what is going to happen in these deeper reservoirs. But what we came up with, sort of rudimentary calculations, was really about one-to-one, that, you know, you're probably putting about as much CO2 back in as you ultimately generate from combusting that that hydrocarbon. Now, at the same time, if you're doing this compared to conventional oil and gas, you're very, you know, every bit you put away is 100% more than you would have otherwise. Right.
Now, I have I was wondering about the scope of this. Now, we have we know that the carbon dioxide is being captured from the basin unit and sent to Saskatchewan.
Yep.
And let's say the antelope, let's say those, both of the antelope plants there in Beulah also. I guess that one is in Center, isn't it? What's the name of the one I'm trying to think of right near Beulah? Well, the Milton or Young, is that the one that's right there at the Beulah?
Center.
Okay, it's Center. Well, I don't want the Center one. I want the ones that are in Beulah, adjacent
Antelope
to
Valley.
The...
Antelope Valley.
Antelope Valley. I had the name right to begin with. Sorry. Okay, Antelope Valley. So if both of those plants, CO2, needed to be captured as well, how much more CO2 are we talking about that would need to be sent by pipeline to oil recovery, for oil recovery or for sequestration? I mean, what is the scope of what we're talking about with power plants versus what we're already dealing with in North Dakota from the gasification?
I don't have the answer for you immediately off the top of my head. Now, we do have that answer. You know, it would take a short amount of digging into the databases that we have. But I'll give you a good guess.
Okay.
More than double.
More than double.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about, we've got a number of power plants here in North Dakota, like the one up at Falkirk, 900 megawatts, as well as the one over in it. We're at 4,500, I think, electricity that we're producing here in the state. It would be a significant number of pipelines that would need to be constructed.
Well, it is, and I guess, again...
Or else it would be injected straight down, and that's why you're exploring the lignite.
Yeah, or the saline formations. Right. You know, I think the best way to contemplate this is, you know, if the U.S. decides they want to move into some sort of carbon management framework as a element of its of regulatory policy, it's hard to imagine we're going to say, okay, well, we're going to reduce our emissions 80% or 90% or something like that. And if you think of the Kyoto signatory or ratifiers, mm-hmm. You know, they're on very modest reductions, 7, 8, 10, 12%. Realistically, I think, you know, if you look at even the most aggressive climate change legislation at the federal level that's floating around, I think the most aggressive I've seen is 60% by 2050. So, and how much of that is assigned back into, you know, your largest sources, which actually are power plants, or how do you start to look at mitigating emissions from mobile sources, automobiles,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is actually very significant mm-hmm. in total, mm-hmm. but on an individual basis, mm-hmm. it's very, very small.
So it'll be incremental reductions over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to giant projects where you go and get everything. Mm-hmm. I think that's unrealistic. And I think the other thing to contemplate is the next generation of power as opposed to completely retrofitting the existing fleet. So how might you, as some of these plants are, you know, meet the end of their useful lives, do you move into different production platforms?
Of course, like no one wants nuclear.
That's another possibility.
seem to be the answer, though. I mean, we know what nuclear can be produced for. It's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
You know, It's the political will to build it.
It's the storage issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the storage issue, and they haven't.
Okay.
But there, I mean, there is a, you know, increased interest in nuclear as a result of this issue. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to go into phases now.
Yes.
The Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership has been proceeding in phases. Phase one, which ended about a year and a half ago, was a two-year effort just to do a characterization of the region. And I'm a characterization with respect to major stationary CO2 sources, so the factories and power plants that produce the lion's share of the CO2, and then also the geologic sinks. So what sources are there, what geologic sinks are there, and how do we match those up, and what is the juxtaposition of those sources and sinks to develop real opportunities for sequestration in our region. We also did a regulatory assessment. We also looked at separation and transportation options, and we did a public outreach component, which ended up being a very important component. We produced an atlas. We produced a documentary with Prairie Public Television, which we think in both cases provides a very balanced view of this topic and not taking an extreme view, but just objectively looking at what are the science aspects of this, what is it we're looking at when we talk about CO2 sequestration.
We have a copy of that, and it's been, some people have looked at it in our agency.
Okay, great. And we'd be happy to provide you with more. In fact, we're updating that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to come out with a new edition. And that's been very successful, and it's found its place in every place from schools to boardrooms and of course, with you folks. And then, of course, to develop a action plan for phase two. Phase two is to develop field validation tests. We're in phase two right now, and I'll talk about those in a moment. Just to give you just a very brief overview of phase one outputs, here you see a map of our region, and you see the Williston Basin and the west, the sedimentary basins, which are the primary targets for sequestration geologically, are kind of that light buff color, and the red are the major stationary CO2 sources in our region. And then you see the pie chart, which breaks them down. Now, obviously, electricity generation in our region is a dominant source of CO2 when looking at stationary sources.
So yeah, not in numbers of sources, but in volume of CO2.
But in volume of CO2 produced.
When you look at the bubbles on the map there, they are proportional to the size of the emission source.
So you know what that large one is down in the Twin Cities?
That,
offhand,
I can't tell you. It shouldn't be
maybe
the refinery.
Maybe it's the one
they're Elk River.
I would guess it's a coal-fired generating station.
Yeah. Should it go that close to the cities? It might be.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know whether any other plant.
It could be that big GRE one down there, too.
My guess is it's coal-fired generation. Because
right.
That almost always is your bigger bubbles here.
We have the backup for all this information in a GIS, in a geographic information system, web-based system called the Decision Support System that is available to our members online. But another thing to note or of interest here is there's a lot of major sources over in the eastern portion of our region, and a lot of the opportunities for sequestration
mm-hmm.
are over in the western part of the
mm-hmm.
region. And you can see that a lot of the sources in our state are located right in a prime spot for sequestration.
Yeah. Namely, right in the middle of the basin.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which affords you the most opportunities. It's the thickest portion of the basin. If you think of the basin as a bowl,
mm-hmm.
that's the thickest, deepest portion. And of course, Weyburn is up here more towards the margins of the bowl, and that's why the sequestration and EOR activities up there are a shallower depth. Okay, just looking at, we talked a lot about enhanced ore recovery. We should talk a lot about enhanced ore recovery. I should say our vision of how this would proceed in our region is, let's explore these enhanced resource recovery opportunities first, because those allow for an income stream to our utilities that would help pay for the infrastructure and the development of these pipelines and other systems and separation and capture systems that will be required to make this a reality. So let's look. We have a tremendous capacity in our region for enhanced oil recovery. And, of course, there's economic benefits to that as well. And, of course, those oil long-term EOR-type activities provide a market for some of the electricity that's produced as well. So it's a win-win-win thing. When you think about in terms of bulk, in terms of just straight carbon in the air, or CO2 in the air, it is kind of a one-to-one thing, but you have to realize that the oil is going to come from somewhere, and it's better to extend the life of existing oil fields than to do exploration and look elsewhere, especially when I live in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. I want to get every drop of oil out of our fields that we can. If you look at some of the numbers here, we've evaluated to date over 160 fields. We see a sequestration capacity of 1 billion tons and incremental oil potential of over 3 billion barrels. This is very significant.
Yeah, those are fields that we believe are viable for enhanced recovery on a regional basis. So we've actually looked at many thousands of fields
over
at this 6, point.
Over 6,000.
From all of those, we come down to this smaller number that we believe are viable for tertiary projects. And then if you look at just the capacity to store CO2 in oil fields, that's much more significant, well over 10 billion tons of CO2 capacity in the fields, that regardless of their applicability for enhanced recovery.
So ultimately, after the enhanced recovery opportunities are there, you can continue to use some of that infrastructure to store more CO2 into the depleted oil and gas reservoirs or into saline formations and things that are located geographically in the same area. Okay, I'm going to wrap up phase one. We'll move on to phase two because that's where we're at right now. Phase one produced over 20 technical reports. The regional characterization information is stored on our decision support system. I already mentioned it's a web-based GIS system. It's available on our members-only website. It contains tens of thousands of pieces of information, everything from individual well data to field-level data to information on various sources. It's got all sorts of tools that our partnership members have asked for.
One of the things we're wondering is how we can become a partnership member, because I understand from the Montana Public Utilities Commission they did not have to pay $14,000 to become a partnership member. They are a partnership member, and they have access to all of this information, and they didn't have to pay those fees. So as a state agency, and we understand that like the Industrial Commission and others are partnership members, and I doubt if they paid $14,000. And so we're just wondering how we can become a partnership member.
Go ahead.
What we've done with respect to all of the public entities is ask for a contribution of something that we can put some value to, because that's very important to the Department of Energy to, you know, show us some involvement. Now, and that may be anything. For instance, the Industrial Commission's Oil and Gas Division actually provides us with staff time in facilitating reviews of documents and things like that. Same thing with the Geologic Survey. We work closely with their staff. And we could certainly arrange for similar sorts of activities with the PSC. Mm-hmm. And we're excited about
that. Yeah, we would love to have you as members, and we can talk about how to do that.
Okay, would be good.
But yes. We and I'll show you a slide coming up here about our membership. We want our members to be contributing members, and mm-hmm. because we find that if they're invested, then they participate, and that's what we really want. Mm-hmm. And what we really want is your participation.
All right.
So, okay, let's move on to phase two. Phase two is what we're in right now. Phase two is a 4-year effort, and we just finished up in October, year one. So we're about a third of the way through year two of this 4-year effort. Phase two, basically, all the things we did in phase one are going to continue. We're going to continue refining our regional characterization. We're going to continue our outreach efforts. We're going to continue assessing the regulatory environment, because that continues to change. We're looking at ways to monetize carbon credits, which is a whole other topic we can get into in a bit here. But the difference with phase two is now we're going to do actual field validation tests or demonstrations of sequestration in our region. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to that. Here's our members. We currently have over 60 members, and they all contribute. They're either contributing with money or time or data or resources. And, you know, the idea behind this membership is we want all the entities that ultimately would have to participate in sequestration in our region to be involved in it right up front so that they understand what's going on and so that we're not developing projects or pushing ideas or concepts or visions that ultimately couldn't practically be applied in our region. So that's why we want all the stakeholders at the table. And we have everybody from state agencies to NGOs to oil and gas companies and most of the major utilities in the region are all part of this effort. And it's been, this is the strength of our partnership right here is our membership. Let's talk about what we're doing in phase two. We have four main field validation tests and then two smaller efforts that we're working on as well. This gives you, again, the sense. Here's Missouri, way up here in extreme northwestern Alberta. We're working with Apache Canada to inject acid gas, which is about 70% CO2 and about 30% H2S, into a Pinnacle Reef structure. This is meant to be depicted here. Pinnacle Reef structures are dome-like structures in the geologic subsurface. They contain oil. Of course, when you're looking for oil, you're looking for traps. And these are perfect little traps for oil. And we're taking the acid gas from one of the facilities there, injecting it for the simultaneous enhanced oil recovery and sequestration of CO2 up there. We've been injecting since December 15th into the particular Pinnacle, and we were the first partnership of all the partners across the United States to actually be injecting in these field validation tests. That is the furthest along of the activities. We have three activities currently underway in North Dakota. One is here at in the Beaver Lodge Formation. Our partner for this activity is Hess Corporation, and we're looking at the deep injection for simultaneous enhanced oil recovery and CO2 sequestration in the Beaver Lodge field. To our knowledge, this will be the deepest enhanced oil recovery project ever in the world. And we're looking at this to have commercial legs and commercial success well beyond our demonstration portion. The question was about what's been happening with the lignites. And I apologize, I've got to move this circle. It should be up here in Burke County. I'm a graphics person, cared less about the geography than it did getting. And what we're looking at there is an unminable coal seam. We've looked at the unminable coal seams with respect to, in some areas, we see some specific geologic conditions that may allow for enhanced coal bed methane recovery. Now, conventional wisdom is that lignites are not good targets for that activity, but conventional wisdom in the Powder River Basin previously was subbituminous coals weren't good targets, but then the engineering and science caught up, and they have a significant coal bed methane play there.
Are they unminable because they're too deep? Or
yes. Okay. Yeah. We considered in our assessment anything below 500 feet would be unminable for the lignites, and 1,000 feet for the subbituminous coals. And we think that's very conservative, that, you're not going to...
Did you say that bottom one on the left is Burke County?
The picture is not physically from Burke County, and the dot on the map is not meant to be in Burke County. The project on the ground will be in Burke County.
We saw some tower thing when we went through there the other...
Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah, this
it's not our drilling.
Our drill
as of yet. Oh. We have a state lease through the North Dakota State Land Department, and we have the permits for downspacing because this is actually to do 5 wells in 1/4 section. But that gives us tight control on the injection so that we can actually see what happens there. And we've contracted with the driller and are close to implementation. What we hope to do is actually get in before load restrictions, go on the roads and do the drilling this spring.
And then once the drilling is done, then do you insert pipes, or does it just, or is the carbon dioxide injected right down the drilling hole, or what happens?
No, these will be cased holes, and then injection will actually be through tubing within the cased holes.
Mm-hmm.
So the holes are cased with steel and cemented to the surface,
mm-hmm.
and then we run a tubing string,
mm-hmm.
Set a packer in the bottom of the hole, and inject through that tubing string and the packer into the desired formation.
Okay.
But that injection will not occur for about, minimum, at present we think about a year.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about the way the five dots look on a dice, that'll be the aerial distribution of the boreholes.
Mm-hmm.
What we will do is pump water from the center of that five spot and look at the response of the coal seams water in those four observation wells. What this does is gives us a very significant knowledge base with respect to the fracture permeability of the coal seam.
Mm-hmm.
At the point we've determined what volume of methane we can produce with that type of a hydrostatic pressure reduction, then we will go ahead and in that center well inject CO2 and look in those observation wells now for the appearance of CO2 if it ever comes.
Okay, so the fourth field validation test is not a geologic sequestration opportunity, but rather a terrestrial one here just over the South Dakota border. It's in South Dakota. This is our wetland test that our partner there is Ducks Unlimited, and they're a major conservation group. They have a lot of expertise with respect to establishing perpetual conservation easements, and they are working to monetize the carbon credits. So we're quantifying how much carbon we can pull out of the atmosphere with these wetlands by managing them in a way that will enhance that. And then they're going to try to sell those carbon credits on the open market. Because a lot of those facilities that, in a carbon-constrained world, if they don't have an opportunity for sequestration, they're going to have to buy offsets. And they're either going to have to buy them from groups out here that are doing the geologic sequestration or terrestrial sequestration. Ducks Unlimited's idea is if we can sell those offsets from these wetlands, we can go buy conservation easements in more wetlands and protect more wetlands. The other two smaller efforts, we're working with Basin Electric to look at the feasibility of using wind power to offset the compression and other electrical penalties that come with CO2 sequestration. You use a significant amount of energy to capture and compress that CO2 for sequestration. So if you're selling carbon credits, that reduces the net amount of carbon credits you can sell because you're producing carbon to capture the carbon. And so you kind of have a dog chasing its tail type thing going on there. And so we're looking at the feasibility of using wind power to offset some of those compression costs, thereby increasing the value of the carbon credits. I mean, increasing the number of the carbon credits. And there's a point where carbon credits, they get to a certain value, wind power becomes a very attractive option for offsetting those penalties. Excelsior Energy is a planned IGCC plant up in the Iron Range of Minnesota, and they've asked us to do a carbon management plan because it's a new facility. DOE was interested in facilitating that, and so they funded half, and Excelsior is funding half, and we're in the process of putting that carbon management plan together.
But they're not over the basin at all, are they?
I was just going to say, in the Iron Range, what is the geology like in terms of?
It's not particularly favorable, although there's something called the Mid-Continent Rift that runs from sort of northern Minnesota all the way down to Kansas. Kind of a big S sort of. That effectually, in effect, what it is a big rip in the center of the continent that eventually filled up with sedimentary rocks. and it's largely it's best identified by gravity anomalies and seismic survey. There's only been a few actual boreholes that have penetrated it to any depth, and so it's kind of a big unknown. And the likelihood and viability of it as a near-term sink is still under investigation. And certainly one of the things that we have been helping in this regard, and it's still under confidentiality, but certainly one of the things that we've been looking at is how might one pipeline CO2 from that location to enhanced recovery opportunities, regionally.
Because it is an IGCC plant, they do have some advantages in that the CO2 concentration is higher, and it also starts out at a higher pressure, so the compression costs are somewhat lower. So,
what's your carbon dioxide source going to be for the two projects, the one in the oil field and the one for the coal seam? Is that
they're still in determination. At present, it looks like in the near term for the coal seam work, we will be trucking the CO2 in. And from how far, we don't know. We're in discussions with a number of prospective suppliers at the moment.
For the oil, for the Beaver Lodge,
Coca-Cola,
we'll probably initially truck it in, and then if it's shown to be viable, then obviously there'll be a pipeline developed, but that'll be between the oil companies and potential sources that are also involved. So, okay, that's phase two. Got two more years of phase two. This past fall, the DOE announced that there's going to be a phase three, and because they're in a hurry to get this technology off the ground, they announced that rather than allowing phase two to go through all 4 years and then starting phase three, they want to run the last 2 years of phase two will be overlapped by the initial 2 years of phase three. Phase three, we're looking at a large-scale sequestration test. A single test for each partnership, and it has to be in the strata that could offset 50% of the CO2 emissions over the next 100 years. So there has to be a very significant capacity for these large-scale tests. The announcement was made that there would be a $67 million available for DOE over the 10-year lifetime of the project, and that had to be matched by 20%, so about $17 million additional dollars. And the first 3 years would be planning, 4 years of injection, and 3 years of closeout. Now, because of the opportunities we have in our region and because of the number of partners we have, the number of commercial partners, both utilities and oil and gas companies, we decided we didn't want to take that approach. We want to meet the DOE requirements, but we want to do a project that's going to have commercial legs. In other words, we want to do a commercial-scale project where CO2 from one of our facilities, hopefully in the Williston Basin, hopefully in North Dakota, would be collected and sold for enhanced oil recovery and have a significant project that's going to continue well past the 10-year DOE research program goals. President's budget just came out. DOE called me the other day, 2 days ago, and said because of the president's budget, some of these things may be changing. They may be moving towards a two-year effort and for planning and then down selecting to four projects rather than seven across the country. For many reasons, we are very confident that we would be one of those four. One is we have the perfect geologic formations, we have the perfect socioeconomic setting, we have great cooperation among the our elected officials, the PCORP partnership is very respected in the Department of Energy and elsewhere, and so we feel that we will be one of those four selected areas. And so originally, phase three application was due on April 10th. And so we've been talking to basically everybody, every utility, and many of the oil companies in the region that have interest in this With the president's budget coming out, it looks like it may be due more along the lines of June. But in any case, they want to start this fall. DOE wants to start on this program this fall. Caveat on all of this is, well, that's the president's budget. When the congressional budget comes out, it could change again. So it's a little bit in a state of flux, but there's a tremendous momentum and interest politically and from the Department of Energy and from our commercial partners to see this
so
get underway.
So the $62 million that was announced last fall.
67.
67. That was just in a plan, and it wasn't actually funded. Is that what you're telling us?
It has not been awarded as of yet.
Thank you.
Not to say it will not.
Okay.
And in what increments it is awarded is another question as well.
Right. So this concept of offsetting 50% of the current levels of CO2 emissions in each region for the next 100 years, just tell me again in simple language how the project with the using the carbon dioxide with enhanced oil recovery would accomplish that.
Well, when we've done our regional characterization, we found these are very rough numbers, but about 600 million tons of CO2 per year from stationary sources in our region.
Yes.
So if you very simplistically, you take that times 100, and then you take 50% of that, it's about 3 billion tons of CO2. Mm-hmm. So we look at our assessments of the geologic formations in our region, and we have to look at geologic formations that have a minimum of 3 billion tons of CO2 capacity. And luckily, we do have tremendous CO2 capacity within the enhanced oil, within the rocks that contain enhanced oil recovery opportunities in our region. Something to keep in mind is we talk about saline formations, and then we talk about oil and gas reservoirs. Most oil and gas reservoirs in our region are saline formations. Okay, Farmer X has an oil and gas deposit because he's got a trap under his land. He's the lucky guy. But the same formation 20 miles away is just a saline formation because he doesn't have the proper trapping mechanism. So we're confident that the types of rocks that we're looking at for enhanced oil recovery have that capacity, ultimately, when you include not just the oil, not just the EOR, not just depleted oil and gas reservoirs, but the entire capacity of the saline formation.
Excellent example of that is the Madison Formation. And its various members is clearly the most prolific oil and gas formation in the Williston Basin. Particularly Mission Canyon is a classic Madison member that's well known for its productivity. And when you look at the Madison, and we have looked at the Madison per se, it's a huge saline formation over the entire basin that has massive capacity. So in this case, you know, our most productive oil reservoir also happens to be a very viable saline formation.
I want to get a couple of things clear. Going back to the enhanced oil recovery, that tertiary potential for North Dakota was 6 billion?
No. That's the region.
Oh, that's the region. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, in the region, 6 billion barrels.
Now, 3, I believe.
3 billion.
3 billion barrels.
Yep.
That's right, it was 3.
Yeah.
The reason I have 6 in my head because I was thinking about $60.
Sure.
It's no wonder there's an increased interest. I mean, that's
great. Yep.
Right.
Yeah, North Dakota's, you know, we have come up with what we believe is a conservative estimate. It's on the order of 250 million barrels. And again, conservative. What that's looking at is reservoirs that are, one, in water flood today. So we've already discriminated against any relatively young fields that might one day be in secondary recovery. And actually, Lynn Helms, and I'm hesitant to venture a guess, but some of those, and we've been working closely with the oil and gas division, some of those tertiary reserves are already counted in the reserve studies that the state has done, although it's a lesser number than the 250. So
significantly
less. For some reason, I'm thinking right around 100 million incremental barrels through CO2 is what the Industrial Commission is saying. And again, that's because that's reserve accounting, and reserve accounting is very prescriptive from an SEC-type perspective. So what you would consider those barrels are probable, if you will, through CO2, whereas what we're talking about is, you know, maybe less probable, but not because of any particular technical reason, largely because of, well, technicalities as opposed to geologic conditions. So, and again, I mean, if you think about this over time in a high-price environment, I would consider the quarter of a billion North Dakota barrels that can be produced through CO2 as a lower limit as opposed to any kind of an upper limit.
Well, I mean, just as I sit here, I hate the word synergy because it's one of those consultant words that you pay a lot to get. But, I mean, there does seem to be a lot of synergy that our staff could potentially offer you.
I agree.
Absolutely. And vice versa. So I would encourage folks to keep up the conversation. I mean, clearly on the Lignite side and the expertise that we have here, as well as maybe even as much, I mean, the terrestrial type recovery, the soil sciences, hydrology.
No, absolutely. Like I see natural opportunity in my land reclamation, actually, and how one might tweak reclamation or not tweak it, but to understand what incremental benefit that has on carbon.
Well, the neat thing is we've also got the other side, which is the economic utility regulatory side, which this all has a huge impact on with regard to the utility companies themselves. So
and that in that regard, it really, I would encourage you in your outreach to reach out to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, the Iowa, South Dakota, the regulatory agencies, because all of the, for example, our jurisdictional utilities are a part of this. And as you say, you're trying to get a group of stakeholders who are all familiar and supportive of the process. And since these could be costs that are coming down the pike for these utilities, I think it's the more information that these folks can receive at the beginning of the process, I think it's going to help everyone. When I went to a meeting this in December, none of the states who were public utility commissions had any awareness of this project at all. None.
Well, interestingly, I know some states are requiring carbon management plans of the proposed facilities, because we have been busy doing those projects as well, and those have been mandated by some of the public utility and or public service commission. There's one other very logical thing that I think would be very helpful for us in terms of working with the with y'all is pipeline
siting
and so on. That's another, as part of phase three, it's very likely we would be looking at installing new pipeline and, facilitation of, you know, how to go about that and so on would be extremely helpful to us.
Right. It might be difficult to site a pipeline from Excelsior, though.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, what likelihood that is within the time frame of our phase three implementation.
This has really been good. I've enjoyed it. I've appreciated it, and I've seen a lot of it at the Research Council. But this to put it all, encompass it all, one through three, and potential has been very helpful.
Good. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and welcome.
Just one question: when you're talking about some of the wetlands and that, with the ability there for carbon sinks, but mentioned the emissions from some of the nitric oxides is whatever. Have you looked, from some of these power plants with the NOx emissions about trying to do something with them too, or haven't you?
We have not looked at NOx emissions per se within the context of this program.
I didn't know it was a side or anything, if somebody looked at that at all or considered it. So.
Probably.
Yeah.
Not within the context of this. No. This
the money pretty well focused on carbon management.
The money of this program is, you know, by definition from the DOE, very much focused on carbon emissions. To give you a mark, a little bit of a sense of scale, the first phase of this project was, I think, initial budget from the DOE was $1.8 million. And we were able to fold in about another $600,000 of non-federal cost share toward that project. And then DOE came in and actually had us significantly expand the regional characterization activities. So the total project value ended up being about $3.4 million for phase one. Mm-hmm. Phase two, the DOE award, was $14.3 million. Mm-hmm. Our cost share to date on that is well over $7 million. So the total value of phase two is in excess of 21. Right now we're, you know, contracted and committed well over $25 million worth of activity over nominally a 5.5 to 6 year period. Now you're looking at, on top of that, this next increment of funding, which all told will exceed $84 million on top of that existing 25. So you're looking at a very significant amount of money going towards developing the understanding, knowledge base, regulatory framework, public acceptance, et cetera, for this as a stable of our, you know, energy platforms over the next several decades.
Yep. Any further questions from anyone? Yes.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't keep up with all the information you put out so quickly. Was there an opportunity for a sequestration in that South Dakota, Minnesota, North Dakota area in South Dakota? Geologically, is there opportunity?
Yeah, the northwestern South Dakota in particular has some opportunities. As does sort of the there's some opportunities in central South Dakota as well.
I think Jack may.
I don't think
about, say the Big Stone Lake area specifically.
Well, that's not really optimal.
Yeah, it's northeast.
It's that basin.
Yeah, it's not really optimal.
It's at the margins of the basin.
So how far would they have to pipe carbon if they wanted? If they were requested to present an alternative remedy of piping carbon to a place where they could sequester it and meet some type of standard, you might suggest how far would they have to pipe it?
Well, what we'd like to do, I mean, if we were to contemplate it, what we'd like to do is actually work with the data itself before suggesting such an option. But I'm not going to say that they absolutely don't have an opportunity right there. Mm-hmm. And until we've actually went back into our data sets and looked, you know, they very well may.
Because there are smaller opportunities. This is a very broad picture here, you know, these large basins. There are smaller localized opportunities for sequestration.
This is a 4.5 million carbon a year plant that we're telling us?
Mm-hmm. 4.5 million ton a year?
Yeah. So it's not the numbers you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a relatively modest amount compared to some of the things that we've been contemplating. And, you know, I mean, if you start thinking about this in the long time frame, all of this really hinges probably on a viable carbon credit market. And ultimately, what you probably see is money flowing to the most viable projects as opposed to carbon flowing from bad locations to good ones.
Easier to ship money than CO2.
You know, I mean, ultimately, that's probably the kind of thing to see. And again, this is why we believe regionally this is a strategic advantage. Mm-hmm. That effectively, what we could be seeing is financial resources from other portions of the nation flowing into this part of the world to offset the cost of doing very significant projects. So
it might be cheaper from somebody from here to pay somebody here to do it than to do it them, you know, themselves.
The utility doing it here might get income from somewhere else for the carbon they sequester.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
correct.
Theoretically.
Can
you tell me what a IGCC plant is, and can we build an IGC plant now?
Yes.
Rather than retrofit it later?
Yes. It stands for Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle. And in effect, what you're looking at there is a gasification platform may or may not be identical to that which currently operates at Beulah. That's a particular gasifier. But conceptually, you're gasifying the coal. Instead of the current configuration at Beulah where you have Antelope Valley providing the power to run the gasifier, what you're doing at an integrated gasification combined cycle is now burning that gasified coal to generate the energy that continues the process.
So you're integrating two
gasification and electricity generation off of one platform. So you're combusting a clean syn fuel as opposed to coal.
Let me ask another question, if I may. If it's an ignorant question,
No.
Narrow it so it sounds intelligent.
No.
I'm not an engineer.
Nor are we, by the way.
In the expense of building a new power plant, and then with the problem prospectively or speculatively having to retrofit it X years in the future, between 0 and 10 years in the future, do you have any sense of numbers? Is it less expensive to build the sequestration model out if you're building a new plant rather than come back and retrofit it 0 to 10 years later?
That's an excellent question, and it is one that the financial community is wrangling about in great detail as we speak. Here's what it really comes to. I mean, if you're comparing apples and oranges here, and what you're trying to do is assign some uncertainty to two things.
We don't know what the cost is in the future.
Precisely. Don't know what the cost is in the future, and don't know that carbon regulations are going to happen at some point in time. You know, and we don't know what they're going to look like. And we don't know that sequestration will be specifically allowed in that regulatory framework. So it's
we do know that IGCC is about 20% more in cost now.
Well, an installed cost today, and how much of that you might get back if carbon becomes a constraint.
Well, and also it doesn't change the amount of carbon coming out of the plant, IGCC does.
It just makes it easier to
capture, but you have the same amount of carbon coming out.
That's correct.
Many people don't understand. You know, don't understand that concept.
No, that's absolutely right. What it does is increases the concentration of carbon into a particular stream that would allow you to capture it. And technology is racing ahead for the potential to retrofit. So, I mean, what you're seeing is, many utilities are not trying to proceed with the IGCC. You know, they're saying, you know, between our lenders and everyone else, you know, we're going to work off of a more conventional platform. And if regulations come, well, you know, we'll deal with it at that time.
But you can see why it's frustrating for the utilities. You know, they're making decisions out 10, 15 years in the future, and there's so many variables and unknowns there that it's just very, very difficult for them to make those decisions.
But it's a very good question, and it's being wrangled about every day.
And it's changing every day. It's almost like odds at the, you know, Las Vegas. Well, yeah. You know, it looks more and more like carbon management is going to be part of the future, but how? And it's
if it takes 10 years to build a plant, you have no idea how the rules are going to change at years 2, 4, 8.
Exactly.
And I think this is why you've seen some utilities publicly state that, you know, hey, federal government, why don't you just choose this regulatory regime and move forward with it? And we've seen, you know, some very big utilities suggest a 20% CO2 reduction over existing baseline, or maybe even 2000 baseline, publicly stated. I personally think the reason they want that is some clarity for the world that they live in.
The devil you know versus the devil you don't know.
Yeah. Now, I think we're going to close the meeting now. It's 12:20, and we thank you very, very much for your coming, and we'll look forward to visiting you with you more about a partnership with the PSC in this project.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So geology.